In one of my favorite books by Gary Parrott and Stephen Kong, called Teaching the Faith and Forming the Faithful, in the foreword is a prized foreword by the late great theologian J.I. Packer. Dr. Packer was talking about a friend of his, another great theologian, a New Testament scholar by the name of Gordon Fee. And Dr. Fee was telling J.I. Packer with tears streaming down his face about the moment when Gordon Fee's little four-year-old grandson jumped up in his lap and he said, "Papa, tell me a story and put me in it. Tell me a story and put me in it." I hope this morning, as we think of God's hidden plan, as we turn to this portion, these final 14 chapters of the book of Genesis, that we will find ourselves a bit in the story as we read the story. So the title of our message this morning, God's Hidden Plan, relates to this. Here's the fallen condition focus, and that is where the gospel can intersect this text. Whether you are Joseph, and I want you to think just for a moment about, I'm going to give you three names, Joseph, Reuben, and Jacob. Whether you are Joseph, who is afflicted, Reuben, who is both betraying and then finds himself betrayed by his brothers, or you are Jacob, deceived and bereaved, we tend towards this kind of cave isolation where we're unaware of exactly how God is coordinating and using our circumstances for good, for a higher end and purpose. If you're like me, and I think many of you are familiar with the last chapter in the book of Genesis, verse 20, Joseph sets everything right for his brothers when he said, "You meant this for evil." And of course, what he's referring to is what takes place here in Genesis 37. He says, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for what? For good. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." And as I was thinking even yesterday about this message, and I was thinking of this phrase, cave isolation, I thought, you know, Mark, you are insulated in your life, your nice 21st century middle class America, suburban, three-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath, two cars in the garage, summer vacation planned, life. And that's very different from where Joseph will find himself, as we'll see in a moment. And so here's the big idea. God's plan, though often difficult and long hidden, may be trusted. And what is hidden may become clear. Now, I don't know about you, but I lose things. Okay, someone said, "Mark," she said to me, I won't name her. She said, "If your head wasn't attached, you'd lose it." And I realized the last two things I've lost have been on the ground. I could not find my watch for a number of days. And I said, "Honey, you won't believe it. I found it under the bed." Okay, well, how did it end up under the bed? And then we had our state park pass. And Cheryl and I just tore apart both our cars looking, where is our South Carolina state park pass? And we both looked, and we looked, and then I had that moment, I think, I know where it is. It's in the last place I left it. And so I said, it'll be the last place I find it, right? Or I'll find it in the last place I left it. And so I said, it's got to be here. Like, matter is neither created nor destroyed. Like, that thing didn't just suddenly become, like, it's not a squirrel in the yard. It's there. But so I'm digging around. I'm like, okay, I'm going to look in Cheryl's car one more time. And so I look, and I get way down low, and there it is. It had slid under the driver's seat. And so what was hidden was found. It was there all the time. And God has a plan. And we are seeing, as we put brackets around Genesis 37 through 50, and this presenting this opening chapter, we're going to see how God works this out. Because too often you and I are living here with these five senses and we're not seeing with the eyes of faith. We're in this realm of smell, touch, hear, taste, all that.
But we need to get a clue here
from the life of Joseph as we think of God's hidden plan.
So I want to outline this chapter for us, if I can. Just six basic portions.
I think it'll make sense. First, so six sets on these 36 verses. Number one is that in verse one, Jacob's situation is contrasted with Esau's, which you can see at the end of chapter 36. Now watch how I phrase the next three sections. Section 2 is in verses 2 through 4. It's real simple. Joseph, the favored son of Jacob. That's verses 2 through 4. Joseph, the favored son of Jacob. Then in verses 5 through 11, this will make sense. Joseph, the dreaming son of Jacob. That's why in a mocking way his brothers refer to him as this dreamer. So first, right, here's the first half. Jacob's situation contrasted with Esau's. Second, Joseph, the favored son of Jacob. Third, Joseph, the dreaming son of Jacob. Fourth, in verses 12 through 24, is Joseph, the afflicted son of Jacob. By the way, we know he is regarded as afflicted, even as Stephen preaches in Acts 7, verses 9 and 10. You don't have to wonder. Joseph is described as afflicted. And then fifth, Joseph, the sold son of Jacob, verses 25 through 28, sold for 20 shekels, the common price of a slave in that time period. And then finally, verses 29 through 36, Reuben, well, two men, Reuben, the regretful brother of Joseph, and Jacob, the devastated father of Joseph. All right? So let's go ahead and begin with our exposition by glancing. We'll work through these 36 verses rapidly so that we'll have some time for some very specific applications, though we'll make some on the way. Kids, let me ask you this. What was the other name for Esau? Do you remember? Another name for Esau. It's a color hint. It sounds like Edom, which is the color for what color? Not red, white, and, or red. Good. And why was that color? Why was he given that name? Why was he also? What was that? Okay. Okay, so he could have been red and hairy, but the main red relates to what was in a bowl. And what color was that stew? You got it. It was red. And what did he do? What did he give up for that bowl of red stew by which he'd acquired a new name? He gave up? Okay, he gave up his birthright. And I think if you go to Mencor, you can get a bowl of ramen in Greenville for $8. Can you imagine saying, for one bowl of ramen, I give up my entire inheritance? That's pretty amazing. It's like not a good deal. But that is Esau. That was Jacob's twin. And we had seen a couple of weeks ago, before I went to Kenya, we saw this language in chapter 36, and I want you to note it in chapter 36, verse 6, that it says, Esau, otherwise known as Edom, he took his household, his livestock, and all his beasts and all his property that he had acquired in the land of Canaan. And it says he went into a land away from his brother Jacob. All right? And it says their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojournings could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau settled in the hill country of Seir, which is southeast of the Dead Sea, away from the land of promise, away from Canaan. So when we ask, what was Jacob's situation? His situation is far different from his twin brother Esau, for it's Esau in his descendants that we read in chapter 36, the final verse, that according, it speaks that they were according to their dwelling places in the land of their possession. What was the possession of the land What was the possession of Esau and his descendants? It was Seir. What was the possession of the land, or what was the possession of Jacob and his descendants? It would be Canaan. All right? So Esau settles in Seir, but Jacob lived in the land. Where did he live? He lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. All right? So now this road divides. And then we come to these verses, this next section, what we call Joseph, the favorite son of Jacob. And for the final time in the book of Genesis, if you've been tracking in the series, we read this sentence, these are the generations. And the writer says, these are the generations, in this case, of Jacob. And this is the structural kind of the way the blocks of Genesis are set apart. 11 times we find that. This is the final time. And so the generations of Jacob are largely going to be focused around Joseph and what takes place with him. Well, how did Jacob regard Joseph? He was this firstborn son of who? Who was his mother? Rachel. And was Rachel Jacob's favorite wife or his least favorite wife? He was his favorite wife, okay? And what symbol did Joseph wear that showed he was his father's favorite son? What did he wear? He wore a nice, cool robe. We don't know how many colors, but it was called by the New American Standard a very colored tunic. It was cool, like you would have noticed it. Like someone that wears a really cool jacket or coat that catches your eye, all right? And there's Joseph, just a lad. He's 17 years of age. If he was here today, he would be a junior in high school. And he's pasturing the flock with his, does it say stepbrothers or just with his brothers? Which does it say in verse 2? With his brothers. Who were his companions? What was kind of his natural brothers he hung with? It was the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. But remember, and he knew, he was Rachel's son. He was Rachel's son, though mama had died, and he was his father's favorite son. And this robe was the symbol of that favoritism. It was this partiality by Jacob where he loved Joseph more than his other sons in a way that embittered the other sons against their brother and, for that matter, against their father. You can say that it was love that produced hate. All right? This inordinate love by Jacob for this son of his old age planted a seed of bitterness in his other, at least the 10 older sons. We can exclude Benjamin from this for the moment. And it put something in the heart of their son, so that we read this in verse 4. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, in others, it was an observable favoritism symbolized by the robe, but it was an observable preference by Jacob for their brother Joseph, that then spawned this hatred. It said they hated him. And they could not speak peacefully to him. They could not make eye contact with him and smile. I don't think it was natural for them to tell jokes, to say, how was your day with the flock? There was something that took place. So he was this favored son. And we'll come back to that later by word of application. But thirdly, we see in verses 5 through 11... that Joseph is the dreaming son of Jacob. So we've asked, what was Jacob's situation? Well, now he's living in the land of his father Isaac. How did Jacob regard Joseph? Well, with a very dangerous favoritism. Well, third, as we come to verses 5 through 11, as we think of Joseph, the dreaming son of Jacob, what happened to him? Well, the Lord gave him two dreams. Some of you know the proverb that says, the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. And we were discussing this last night at dinner, and we thought, what was it about this 11th of 12 sons, the son of the favored son of the favored wife. What was it that moved him to feel like he needed to share all the content of these dreams with his brothers? In other words, was he just naive? Or did he not realize he was basically sticking them with this red hot poker? He was irritating. He was just dry. He was putting what we say, what? Salt in the wound. What was it? But the Lord gives him these two dreams. Look at them. He says, hear this dream. It's as though he's oblivious to their hatred, verse 4. It's as though he is obtuse. He is completely undiscerning that his brothers weren't really able to speak peacefully with him any longer. And he has these two dreams. You see these in verses 5 through 11. One says, we're binding sheep in the field. Well, the brothers relate to that. Okay, that's a normal everyday occurrence. But he says, look, we were binding sheep. Mine stood up and yours stayed down. And in fact, yours not just stayed down, but they gathered around my sheep and they bowed down. This act of obedience or submission. And his brothers are incredulous. Really? Like, are you indeed thinking you're going to reign over us? Is that the infallible interpretation of that dream, little bro? Are you going to rule over us? And so Moses says, so they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Someone has said, when you're in a hole, stop digging because you're already in a hole. Well, with his brothers, he had no credibility. They hated his guts. You could say it that way. They despised him. Blood might be thicker than water, but in this case, the fact that they shared a father, only a father, was not enough. They despised him. Rather than protecting him, they despised him. Then there's a second dream. We see this in verse 9. And again, he tells his brothers, hey, guys, one more night, one more dream. I've dreamed another dream. Makes me think of that song. What's the song? I dreamed a dream. But this is like the dream that you don't want to share. So I dreamed this, and here I was, and there was the sun, the moon, and 11 stars. And they got the picture. They knew, so did his father, what he's referring to. He says, they were bowing down to me. And so he not only tells it to his brother, but he tells it to his father. And you would think that if anyone would give Joseph the benefit of the doubt, it would be his father. After all, he was the favored of his father. But his father rebukes him. And he says, what is this dream you've dreamed? Come on, you can't be serious. Do you really think your mother and your brothers and I are going to bow ourselves to the ground before you? And then there is in verse 11, this third statement, right? You have repeated from 4, they hated him, could not speak peacefully to him. Verse 8, they hated him even more. Now here, and for this reason, for his dreams and for his words. And then finally, in 11, it says, and his brothers were jealous of him. And Stephen, in Acts 7, verse 9, picks up on that. There was this jealousy. There wasn't just the fact that he was their half-brother or that he was the son of their father's favorite wife, but he was the son who had the multicolored robe that symbolized that favoritism. He was the one, verse 2, that had brought a bad report of even the sons of these two concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah. He had been, you might say, kids, you say tattletale. Does anyone use that word anymore? Like, I'm tattling on you. He was reporting the news, and it wasn't positive. And it did not endear him to his brothers. But then we read verse 11, it says, and his brothers were jealous of him. But in the same way that Mary probably treasured and pondered the words of the angel that she would be carrying the Messiah in her womb, it says, his father kept the saying in mind. I think he like filed that away and said, this might prove useful at some point.
Let's move on, if we can, to see Joseph, the afflicted son of Jacob. And so we could ask the question, how did Joseph's brothers deal with him? And you know what this feels like? His father sends Joseph from their village, sends them north to Shechem. And he's like, you need to check on them. There's a book on leadership where they talk about MBWA, management by walking around. And so I think it was Jacob that think, I'll send this youngest, who's hated by all his brothers, to do a quality control check on the animal husbandry practices of the 10 oldest. And you can kind of understand this later, maybe five chapters later, when they're all starving. And Jacob says to the 10, why do you guys just sit there staring at each other? Like, okay, you know what that's like? Someone just stares at you and they're doing nothing. And so I think he's wondering, dad's thinking, I think you need to check on them. Let's see how they're doing. And he sends them. But he doesn't find them there in Shechem. But he runs into somebody providentially, and they said, hey, I think I heard one of them say, verse 17, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph, we read, Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. And so he's already hated. Let's think about Joseph just for a moment. He's already hated. His brothers are jealous of him. They are not able to speak sweetly or peaceably with him, or peacefully with him, peacefully with him. And now we come to verse 18. They see him from afar. In fact, you couldn't miss it. It's like a guy with a jacket or a coat that is just unmissable, unmistakable, right? Be like if I preached in an all red three-piece suit or something. I'd be like, you need to wear sunglasses. And it says, they saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. And kids, just for a moment, I want you to hear me. Do not think that you can harbor the seed of bitterness toward your brother or sister, or toward mom and dad, or toward a cousin, or a neighbor, or a boy in school, or a boy or girl in school. Don't think that you can keep that seed of hatred and bitterness in you without it eventually growing up and sprouting where you would do what would shock even you. And so that's what the brothers do. They conspire. That means they agree to do something really bad together. It says they conspired what? Against him. For what purpose? To kill him. They shared the same father. They knew their brother was probably sent to check up on them. No doubt he probably bought some provisions. But here are 10 older brothers. And once they see him at a distance and he's making his way to them, they're concocting this plan to spill his blood and murder him, something that God says in Proverbs 6 that he hates. In fact, we read this in Stephen's sermon in Acts 7, verses 9 through 10. It says, and the patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt. And I'm going to stop there. We'll read the rest of it later. And the patriarchs, those first 10 sons of Jacob, with his two wives and two concubines, were jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt. And so how do they deal with him? They conspire. And what do they call him? They use this labeling language in verse 19. They said to one another, here comes what? Here comes this dreamer. And translate it, who does he think he is? This sniveling little brat, little boy. Who does he think he is? Is he going to check on us? Is he going to give a bad report to dad like he did to Bilhah and Zilpah's sons? And you see what happens. Let's track through this in verses 12 through 24. They say, let's kill him.
Let's throw them into one of the pits. In other words, in their mind, the solution was to get rid of him, to kill him. Right? And then rather than saying we killed him, we'll tell dad he was devoured by a wild animal. And then nothing will happen to those dreams. Nobody will be bowing down to him. No 11 stars, a sun and a moon. No 10 chiefs to this one, you know, sheep. That's not going to happen. He'll be gone. But Reuben speaks up, and you'll notice this. He speaks up, and he says, wait a minute. Let's not take his life. No. Shed no blood. But you see what he does. On the one hand, he prevents his brothers from killing Joseph, but he's still willing to kidnap him. He's still willing, basically, to bind him. And he says, look, let's not take his life. Shed no blood. Cast him into this pit here in this wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him. Now, actually, he had a good motive. You can see that at the end of verse 22. And Moses says that he might rescue him. That is, that Reuben might rescue Joseph out of their hand to restore him to his father. This is the same Reuben, ironically, the same Reuben who slept with his father's concubine. You might know that, okay? That's chapter 35 in verse 22. Reuben steps up. Though in a sense an act of rebellion against his father when he slept, we had an inappropriate relationship with his father's concubine. Now here he rises up to try to spare Joseph and protect him from his brothers. So it says, when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was what? No water. Now look at the callousness as we look finally, or we look to this next section, verses 25 through 28, on how Joseph is the sold son of Jacob. Not only the dreaming son of Jacob, not only the afflicted son of Jacob, but he's also the sold son of Jacob. He's stripped of his robe, no doubt a visual irritation to his brothers, the robe of many colors that he wore. And so they cast him into this pit. There's no water. The most basic thing when you're alone and you're basically in a jail cell in the desert, in the wilderness, water, the one thing you need badly, he doesn't have. Now look at the callousness of his brothers in verse 25. While he's there dying potentially of thirst, what are they doing? Eating. Then they sat down to eat. As the commentator Derek Kidner just says, this is utter filial callousness. They didn't care. They didn't care. Now let's look at Joseph, the sold son of Jacob. We ask this question. What is it that Joseph's brothers do without Reuben's knowledge? So I want us to think about this. You have 12 brothers. One is at home, Benjamin. There are 10 older brothers. And here is this favored son of the favored wife in the pit. No water to drink. We think Reuben then is off somewhere at this point. Okay, he's off. He's off tending the flocks, tending the herd. And when you read the Ishmaelites in verse 25, or you see the Midianite traders, think of those as coordinating terms. They're shared terms. We're not talking two different groups, okay? And the point is that they're sitting down to eat. Here comes this caravan. And they know that Brother Reuben, who's not there presently, has advocated for Joseph. He said, spare his life. They don't necessarily know why Reuben wants him in the pit, because Reuben has in his mind, according to Moses, a plan to rescue him. We see that at the end of verse 22. But then Judah speaks up. And when he says, what profit, he asks this question, all right? It sounds maybe innocent enough. What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? But profit there is not a metaphor. He's not simply saying what benefit. He's actually thinking dollar signs, ching, ching. He's thinking 20 shekels. He's thinking we have an asset here that can be sold for our benefit. He says, look, come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, verse 27, and let not our hand be upon him. For he is our brother, our own flesh. Now, do you get what's happening right there? He is minimizing the action. He's glossing it. It's like taking a piece of rotten wood and putting the best quality, I don't know, Benjamin Moore paint on that thing. And you think, that's beautiful. But behind it's rotten. So these words, let's not put our hand on him. In other words, let's honor what Reuben has asked. Let's do that. And it sounds very brotherly. He's our brother. He, after all, we're family. But this is one of the brothers that hated him, who could not speak with him peacefully, who was jealous of him. This is one of the brothers, no doubt, that as they saw Joseph from afar, was conspiring and thinking, how can we kill him so that his dreams come to nothing. And it says in verse 27, and his brothers listened to him. And there's an application here for a moment. And even children, I want to get your special attention. Sometimes we want to do this on Sunday mornings, Sunday nights, where you think, how does this apply to me? Be careful what you're saying, because you never know who's listening to you. And be careful who you listen to. Be careful either way. Here it is. Judah rises up. He presents this proposal. And it sounds very nice. Look, there's no benefit in killing him. After all, he's our brother. He's our own flesh and blood. Hey, look how convenient this is. Here's some traders passing by. Let's just strike a bargain and it'll be gone. It'll be no problem. He won't be dead, but he'll be out of what? He'll be out of our hair. And so they sell him off for the price of a slave to the Ishmaelites. Just 20 shekels of silver. Little brother. They pull him up. Reuben's not there. 20 shekels here. Younger, irritating brother absent. The coat there. Transaction done. Let's move to our final section in verses 29 through 36. What we call Reuben, the regretful brother of Joseph, and Jacob, the devastated father of Joseph. Reuben returns. No doubt, he's very interested in protecting his little brother, but the pit's empty. And he tears his clothes. Obviously, this tearing of his clothes, and he returns to his brothers. He is in anguish, regret. I left my little brother with my brothers. I left him unprotected, and now he's gone. And he says, the boy is gone. And I, where shall I go? What shall I do? In other words, what is my next step? And I think Reuben, as the older brother, knew. He knew he would have to give account to his father, Jacob. After all, it was Jacob who had sent little Joseph, this 17-year-old lad, to check on his 10 older brothers. And he's just tore up. But look at verse 31. I've often wondered what happened between this anguished cry of Reuben. The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go? It says, then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. It's as though at this point, maybe Reuben felt he had no choice. He was in too deep, but to go along with his brothers. Like it wouldn't be acceptable to say, well, Dad, we sold Joseph. and here's your 20 shekels. Could we keep 10%? Like, that wasn't going to work. So the only plausible explanation was to say, I'm so sorry. Look, is this his? And I want you to notice what happens. They come back. It says, they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, we don't know when it says they sent it. Did they send that by a delegation of servants? Did they send it by a delegation of a couple of brothers? But look at this language. Look at this distancing language, absolving this hand-washing language of, this we have found, please identify whether it is your son's robe or not. They don't say whether it is our brother Joseph's robe or not. And hatred, a loss of real affection, produces this type of they, them, and us. You guys. It creates this turf protecting, these dividing lines. And we've really been tested about that as a church this year. I think we can all acknowledge that. Let's acknowledge that. That's been tough. And you see it just so plainly here with these words sent to Jacob with Joseph's bloodied robe. Look at Jacob's response, the response of a devastated father. Do you have to imagine this? Jacob, the patriarch, is told a lie about his second to youngest son whom he loved. He's described, Moses says he loved him more than all his other sons. And he lives with this belief for a number of years, until we get to the latter part of this book, that his son is dead. He's mourning what hasn't actually taken place. Yes, his son is afflicted. Yes, his son was sold into slavery by his other sons. But it says he tore his garments just like Reuben had, and he put sackcloth on his loins, and he mourned for his son many days. And you know what this is like? If you've ever sat, you've come to someone who's just suffered the loss of a mate, of a child, something absolutely devastating, and you don't even know what to say. It's like the silence. You don't want to ruin the silence. You want to be encouraging, but you know that they're completely gutted. It's like you put a knife and you tore their insides out. And you know that almost anything you say is going to sound hollow. And there's Jacob. And it says, all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. Look at this. Their old father was given a false narrative. He was lied to cover up a deed of hatred against his next to youngest son, the son whom he had sent to check on these brothers and on their welfare. And it says, no, don't comfort me. I will go down to Sheol to my son mourning. And it says, thus his father wept for him. He tore his garments. He put sackcloth on. He mourned many days, and he stiff-armed his sons and daughters to say, no, leave me alone. I will mourn. I'll go down to Sheol mourning for him. And I can only imagine there the tears like rivers on his cheeks, on that old, weathered face of a man who'd been sold a bill of goods by his own sons. He was consigned to a house of grief for many, many days. And while he is undergoing that affliction, Joseph is undergoing his own. It says, meanwhile, the last verse of the chapter, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. And there's a sense in which the very first domino has has fallen. As we read through this book, we will want to remind ourselves that God always has a plan. He's working that plan out so that all the covenantal promises that you see, whether there's that first gospel promise made in, that's embedded in the curse to the serpent in Genesis 3:15, whether it's the promise, the covenant promises made to Noah, whether it's the promises made to Abraham, to Abram in Genesis 12, God is merging all these together. He's writing this story. And so at this point, in this last big long chunk, 14 chapters of Genesis, God is working out his plan. God is keeping his covenant promises. God is creating a people for himself. And we will see it over many months from a Hebrew Israel to a Christian Israel. He is going to have a seed. There will be the seed of the woman through this son, even through Jacob, and ultimately through Judah. Isn't this amazing? Even through Judah's line, that there would be a Messiah, one who would crush the head of the serpent. He too would be stripped. He too would be hated. There are those who would be jealous of him. And he too would be betrayed for coins that shone silver. And as Peter preached at Pentecost in Acts 2 and said, though it was through the hands of sinful men that the Prince of Life was nailed to the tree, it was not apart from God's foreknowledge and eternal plan. We don't have here an allegory from the life of Joseph that we put over against as perfectly fulfilled in the life of our Lord Jesus. But we certainly have an illustration, as we'll see over coming weeks, that all that's taking place here, God is weaving together the events in the lives of the patriarchs such that Joseph will be able to say with full heart and with no regret and confidence in the living God that though you meant this for evil, Genesis 50, verse 20, he'll say, God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So he says, so do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones. And it says, thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. We will boomerang back and forth to Genesis 50, 20 to give perspective as we journey through these last 13 chapters now of Genesis over the coming weeks. God's plan. It may not be so obvious. Some of you are wondering, what in the world is God doing in my life? I'm in a trial I do not understand. I am dealing with something that I do not have the strength to bear under it, and you don't. Some of you are in the middle of trials, and those are of different shapes. Sometimes, right, that's illness. Sometimes it's a wayward child. Sometimes you're just struggling. You are fighting indwelling sin. You're fighting a besetting sin, and you just cannot get rid of it. Maybe some of you kids, you're wondering, will I ever know if I'm a Christian? Can I be a Christian? And the answer is yes. Because he says, Jesus says, everyone who comes to me, I'll never turn away. But here's the good word for us today. That what is hidden to you is plain to God. What is confusing to us is clear to him. We get the benefit of reading our Bibles backward. We know the end of Genesis 50. We know that God was tipping this first domino to knock down a whole bunch of other dominoes because he was going to bring, through Abram's loins, through his seed, and through Judah, a son who, though his enemies and his detractors were happy to strip him, to betray him, to put him in bonds, and would have been happy, and just as Joseph's brothers would have been happy to kill him, they were happy to kill the Prince of Life. Because of this, we know the ultimate goodness of God. And that, though hidden, is incredibly clear for us this morning. May God help us all by faith to embrace that to the glory of his name.